طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we will continue our coverage of the Balfour Legacy Conference held on November 11th in Cambridge, Massachusetts. But first we want to take a look at the emerging story involving the confession of former United States National Security Advisor Michael Flynn to lying to the FBI about efforts of the incoming Trump administration to help Israel avoid censure at the UN Security Council concerning its illegal settlements on occupied Palestinian land. The mainstream media is handling this as a story involving Flynn's collusion with the Russians, but you hear or read little about the fact that much of this involvement is at the behest of Israel. As usual, the media is quick to blame the Russians and slow to include Israel's heavy-handed involvement. Ali Abu Nima exposes Israel's involvement in the following article written in the Electronic Intifada and manages to also expose the involvement of the Trump transition team, including his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and the complicity of the mainstream media. Here is Ali Abu Nima writing in the Electronic Intifada. Former U.S. National Security Advisor Michael Flynn entered a guilty plea Friday to lying about efforts by the incoming Trump administration to help Israel avoid censure at the UN Security Council over its illegal settlements on occupied Palestinian land. Yet several major U.S. media outlets were initially silent about the Israeli connection. Flynn appeared in federal court in Washington to admit that he lied about conversations he had with the Russian ambassador last December, in the weeks before Donald Trump took the oath of office. The single count charges that Flynn lied to federal investigators about two conversations. In the first, on December 22nd, Flynn asked the Russian envoy to delay or defeat the UN Security Council vote condemning Israel's settlements. In the second conversation, a week later, Flynn had asked the Russian government to refrain from retaliating harshly to sanctions imposed by the Obama administration, an act, ironically, that would benefit the United States. According to the charge sheet, Flynn made false statements to the FBI about these conversations during questioning on January 24, 2017, days after Trump took office and Flynn was already National Security Advisor. Flynn's guilty plea is a result of the ongoing investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller, the former FBI director appointed by the Department of Justice in May to lead a broad investigation sparked by allegations of ties between the Trump campaign and Russia. Flynn's plea is widely taken as an indication that he is cooperating with Mueller and that he may provide evidence against other targets of the investigation. The Trump transition team's effort to halt the UN resolution was successful. It passed with no opposition on December 23rd after the Obama administration declined to cast a veto. Flynn's plea adds to the mounting evidence of Trump's collusion with Israel to shield it from accountability for its violations of international law. Last month, the Wall Street Journal reported that Trump's son-in-law and Middle East envoy, Jared Kushner, was being probed by Mueller over contacts with Israeli officials aimed at thwarting the UN vote. In October, Trump campaign foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos also pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI in the course of the Mueller investigation. While Papadopoulos is a far more junior figure than Flynn, he had championed Israeli settlers during an April 2016 visit to Israel. Papadopoulos' remarks impressed one Israeli right-wing observer that Trump was somewhat of a prism on world affairs and that there are some reasonably informed people trying to advise him. Yet, despite the clear signs that Trump's consistent concern seems to be advancing Israeli rather than Russian interests, the focus on U.S. mainstream media has barely paid attention to the collusion with Benjamin Netanyahu's government. Reports on the websites NPR, CNN, and CBS about Flynn's plea, seen by the Electronic Intifada on Friday morning, initially made no mention of Israel at all. CBS and CNN later added information about Flynn's role on trying to thwart the UN resolution vote. NBC and the New York Times mention Israel in their reports, respectively, in the 10th and 8th paragraphs. To its credit, NBC noted that Flynn, while not yet in office, was trying to get the Russians to do what Israel wanted and thus undercut U.S. policy. Citing sources briefed on the inquiry, the New York Times reported that Mueller's investigators had learned through witnesses and documents that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel asked the Trump transition team to lobby other countries to help Israel. Investigators have learned that Mr. Flynn and Mr. Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor, Jared Kushner, took the lead in these efforts. The newspaper states, adding that Mueller's team has emails that show Mr. Flynn saying he would work to kill the vote. On Twitter, CNN's Jim Sciotto, citing an FBI statement, pointed out that Flynn contacted the Russians after being asked by a senior Trump transition official to find out how foreign governments stood on the coming UN Security Council resolution about Israel. That indicates that Flynn might well have been in touch with other Security Council members, not just Russia. Yet despite this, the overwhelming focus remains on alleged collusion with Russia. The obvious Israeli connection has not garnered the same obsessive attention from liberal politicians and pundits who have jumped on every Russiagate allegation of collusion, no matter how dubious or fictional. Longtime media observer Sam Husseini of the Institute for Public Accuracy noted the discrepancy, observing in a tweet that it is funny how the Israeli press is highlighting Flynn apparently lying to help Israel more than the U.S. press. So there you have it. Ali Abu Nima writing in the Electronic Intifada concerning the White House's collusion with Israel that somehow is escaping exposure in the American media. Surprise, surprise. Okay, and now, as promised, we return to the coverage of the Balfour Legacy Conference, held at the First Parish Church in Harvard Square on November 11th of 2017. First, you will hear Leila Farsakh, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, who is also a Senior Research Fellow at Beer Zeit University in the West Bank of Palestine. Leila gives an introduction and overview of 100 years of the Balfour Declaration. She will be followed by Nancy Murray, longtime activist for Palestinian rights, a co-founder of the Gaza Mental Health Foundation, and a key organizer of this Balfour Legacy Conference. Nancy will speak on the consequences of the Balfour Declaration for the United States. First, Leila Farsakh.
Thank you, Nancy. Thank you, everybody, for being here. I will start really by specifically thanking Nancy Murray and Elaine Hegobian, because without them, this conference could not have taken place. I really want to ask you all to just give them a clap of applause. Their vision, their perseverance, and their commitment to Palestine and to issues of justice has always moved me and been a source of inspiration for many people of my generation and also younger. So thank you very much for organizing this, and thank you all for being here. As you know, the aim of this conference is to discuss the legacy of the Balfour Declaration, which was issued by Britain exactly 100 years ago on the 2nd of November 1917. This small paragraph of 67 words, as you know, has given the National Zionist Movement the right to create a Jewish national home in Palestine. It is a declaration that had major consequences not only on the indigenous people of the land, the Palestinians, but also on what is called the Jewish question, namely the issue of anti-Semitism in the West and the concept of what constitutes a people, a nation, and what about citizens' rights. It has also been a declaration that sowed the seed of one of the longest and intractable conflicts of the 20th and the 21st century, namely the Palestinian conflict, one that is far from being resolved, despite the fact that this year we commemorate, next year we commemorate 70 years of the Nakba, or the recreation of the State of Israel, 50 years of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, and 25 years nearly of Oslo peace process that failed so far to bring any peace. So what this conference seeks to do is to shed new light on how this Balfour Declaration has been important, why reviewing it today is necessary, and what implications it has still today on the domestic, regional, and international level. In my view, and I think what various speakers would try to show you today, is that this reviewing this Balfour Declaration today is important because it helps us in three main things. It helps us to re-examine and understand what this conflict is about, and why it has lasted so long. Secondly, it helps us to rethink the nation state and the two-state solution as a possible venue for peace. And thirdly, it makes us rethink the kind of actor and strategies needed to achieve peace in Israel and Palestine, as well as outside it. So with regards to how the Balfour Declaration and confronting the consequences entails, I think the first thing reconsidering the Balfour Declaration is important is because it reminds us that this conflict is a settler-colonial conflict. The declaration created a settler-colonial reality in Palestine. As the word of, and I'm going to here just read the 67 words, which are actually quite phenomenal in how they impacted the history of the region. It says it was a letter from the British Foreign Secretary in 1917, Lord Balfour, to Lord Rothschild, who is the representative of the Zionist movement at the time. It says, and here I'm quoting, that Her Majesty views with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this objective, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done that may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the right and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. This declaration thus set the colonial reality in Palestine in the fact, in many ways. First, that it acknowledged the Zionist movement, which was fundamentally an Ashkenazi Western nationalist movement, as a representative of the Jewish people. It also made clear that it prioritized the political right of European Jewish immigrants over the indigenous population, namely the Palestinians. The Balfour Declaration also gives the Jewish people a term that it does not define, and which is much contested by Jews and others, the right to self-determination at the expense, at the same time as ensuring their rights as citizens in other countries. It denies this right to self-determination to the Palestinians or the indigenous population. It also gives them civil and religious rights, reflecting thereby an imperial racial attitude towards natives assumed not to exist or not to merit equality and political agency. Meanwhile, the Balfour Declaration also reveals that from its outset has implicated international actors. It shows us that this conflict has already had, always had imperial sponsors, first Britain, today many would argue the United States, and it always had its international culprits, namely the League of Nations, which incorporated the Balfour Declaration in the British Mandate of Palestine, and also today with the United Nations, whose various resolutions have been central to defining how this conflict is to be resolved or not resolved. So, seen from the perspective of the Palestinian people, the Balfour Declaration is a proclamation of war on them. This war was waged over the next decades by Zionist movement with money, legal means and propaganda, with the support of the British Empire and then afterwards with the U.S. support. Reviewing the Balfour Declaration today helps us to understand that the conflict, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, did not start in 1948 or in 1967. It started in 1917. And it has not only the Palestinian and the Israeli involved, it also has international powers, a UN agency, superpowers as well, and local societies. Mann would also argue that the Balfour Declaration was an assault on the Jewish people, specifically those living in the Middle East, but not only. We know today how old and large Jewish communities in the Middle East, in Iraq, Egypt, Yemen, Morocco, were opposed to the Balfour Declaration and saw their lives linked with Arab neighbors, not with Ashkenazi Western Jews. The creation of Israel complicated rather than harmed the diversity of the Jewish people, their link to the Middle East, as well as Jews outside of Palestine. It also changed the character and shape of the Middle East in ways that led to polarizations we're still living with today. Fourthly, reflecting on the Balfour Declaration helps us to examine the notion of the state and the nation state as a solution, our protector of people's rights. It reminds us that the conflict is not about religion, but about land. It is about political rights and the extent to which the nation state can be protector or usurper of these rights. The declaration, of course, does not talk about a state. It promised the creation of a national home for the Jewish people, not a state. A home, a national home, can take various forms, of course. It can be an autonomy, it can be a self-government, it can be a state in the American sense of a state, the way that Massachusetts, for example, is a state in a federal structure of the United States of America. And many Zionist, humanist Zionist thinkers like Martin Buber and Yehuda Magnus have indeed pushed for the argument of that the Jews do not need a state in Palestine, they are a nation, and the solution in Palestine should be a binational state. Yet the vagueness of the Balfour Declaration with regards to what a national home meant is key to understanding the problem, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the continuity of this conflict, but also how we can rethink the solution to this conflict. It shows us that the question of collective and individual rights of any person living in Palestine needs to be considered and thought of how it can be protected. The 20th century concept of self-determination sought in the nation state the political means to protect collective and individual rights. This is why the Zionist movement, since Herzl, wanted to create a state for the Jewish people, and why the Palestinians, by 1971, called for the establishment of a Palestinian state, and by 1988 accepted the two-state solution as the only way to give Palestinian political rights. However, The nation state, as Hannah Arendt and others already demonstrated, also robs the people who do not belong to the nation of their political right. The nation state is bound to create refugees, people with no right to have rights, as she called it, as was well exemplified in Palestine in 1948 with the creation of Israel, and also as happened before already in Germany in the 1930s and 40s. The Palestinian refugee problem remains today one of the oldest and largest problems in the Middle East, that no nation state or two-state solution have been able to resolve. Last but not least, reflecting on the Balfour Declarations helps us to see that no solution can be obtained for two communities fighting over the same piece of land without addressing the root cause of the problem, namely the settler colonial reality of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It brings us back to the question of political rights of those who live in the land and how to honor them rather than deny one group in favor of another under the auspice of a two-state, one state, or however number of states. Reflecting on the Balfour Declaration and considering its consequences, ask from us to rethink how we can find a solution that is based on reconciliation that acknowledges historical realities rather than ignore them, and calls for us to think about how we can find a genuine compromise that is based on justice and equality, not on imposition of the will of the stronger over the weaker. It also highlights to us the various actors involved in the conflict, not simply the Palestinians and the Israelis, but also the international organizations and the local communities, UN agencies, and local activists. I think we are very lucky today that we have such prominent and important speakers who have worked a lot on this conflict and who can help us shed light and understand the meaning and implications of the Balfour Declaration in its various dimensions. Above all, they will also help the peculiarity and speciality of this uniqueness of this conference, and why I would thank very much Nancy for it, on her insistence that we also try to have, we're having workshop this afternoon in order to address together in various workshops the how to address the injustices created over the past 100 years and find strategies and actions for everybody to try and move towards peace.
That was Leila Farsak, framing 100 years of the Balfour Declaration. And now, Nancy Murray speaks to the consequences of the Balfour legacy for the United States.
Okay, now I'm going to talk about consequences for the USA. There's no time here to describe the tension in 20th century U.S. policymaking circles about whether the Balfour Declaration and the emergence of the State of Israel served or impeded U.S. oil interests in the Middle East. This is the subject of lots of books, and I recommend one by Irene Genzier, Dying to Forget. In the decades following Israel's rout of Arab armies in the Six-Day War, the notion that it was an essential Cold War ally and barrier to the spread of Arab nationalism held increasing sway. And now in the 21st century, we see a convergence of interests tied to a never-ending war on terror through a massive web of military, security, and technological connections that bind the U.S. and Israel together in what has become an almost symbiotic embrace. An article in the Israeli paper Haaretz in January 2015 sheds light on this convergence of interest while suggesting that Israel is no mere client state. Amir Oren is writing in January 2015 about a visit by 9 Israeli official colonels to Fort Benning, Georgia, following Israel's summer 2014 offensive in Gaza. Quote, they gave a 3-day joint workshop on the lessons learned from Operation Protective Edge, particularly on tunnel warfare. Oren then adds, quote, not all the secrets were revealed to their hosts. He goes on, only a week after Protective Edge had ended, he writes, the Pentagon's Joint Chiefs of Staff hastened to fly a team to Israel, and General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, publicly absolved the IDF of war crimes, saying Israel had gone to extraordinary lengths to limit civilian casualties, end quote. You will recall what Operation Protective Edge was. A massive loss of life and devastation was inflicted by air, ground, and naval assault on the tiny Gaza Strip. But this was of little concern to a superpower with more than 1,000 military bases and installations in at least 125 countries, which gives Israel more military aid each year than it gives to all the other countries combined. In return, Israel is expected to do its part for the hegemonic power. But Israel, which has long been classified as the, quote, most militarized nation in the world, end quote, by the Global Militarization Index, has priorities of its own, including its own robust arms trade with 130 countries. Documents leaked by Edward Snowden reveal that its spying on and within the U.S. is a major concern, quote, despite inarguable ties between the U.S. and its closest ally in the Middle East, Adam Goldman and Matt Apuzzo wrote for the Associated Press in 2012, quote, and despite statements from U.S. politicians trumpeting this friendship, U.S. national security officials consider Israel to be at times a frustrating ally and a genuine counterintelligence threat, end quote. Of course, this is not how Israel is presented by supporters who trumpet the, quote, shared values that tie the nations together. On its website, AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, states that, quote, the commitment to democracy, the rule of law, freedom of religion and speech, and human rights are all core values shared between the U.S. and Israel, end quote. Now, there are other shared values that never get mentioned, but which I would maintain provide the U.S.-Israel relationship with its bedrock foundation. These relate to the settler colonialism that in the 17th to the 19th centuries powered the ethnic cleansing of the indigenous inhabitants of what became the continental United States, and which in the century since the Balfour Declaration has steadily dispossessed the indigenous population of Palestine. Common to both colonizing projects has been a sense of racial superiority and divine entitlement, an expansionist vision and ready resort to the tools of extreme dehumanization and militarized violence. Roseanne Dunbar Ortiz's book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, at times sounds like an indigenous people's history of Palestine. In the time remaining, I want to touch briefly on five consequences set in motion by the Balfour Declaration, which have had a significant impact on the United States, both domestically and internationally. First is what can be called the political sacred cow syndrome, with a shared values mantra taking the place of forthright discussion where Israel is concerned. Israel, of course, is not the only sacred cow. The G word, four-letter word, guns, is another one. But still, seeing the entire Congress rise as one from their seats 29 times during Netanyahu's speech on May 24, 2011, was like watching a choreographed adulatory ritual. It is striking that the more than $125 billion given to Israel since 1949, these are Congressional Research Service figures, that amount of money has rarely been brought up for critical debate. Outside of Congress, a Palestinian exception to the First Amendment has been carved out through intimidation techniques honed by well-funded pro-Israel support groups with Mark McCarthyite tendencies. The mainstream media has not been spared and has, either as a result of pressure or preference, resorted to the self-censorship vividly illustrated in the film The Occupation of the American Mind. And putting Israel beyond the reach of well-informed discussion is hardly conducive to sound decision-making. So that's consequence one. Two, second consequence is the emergence of a conglomeration of organizations to tend to the sacred cow, the many-tentacled lobby with AIPAC at its center. Its electoral clout is provided by Christian Zionism, which the Reverend Jerry Falwell claimed had 70 million adherents eager to see Israel expand throughout its biblical territory in order to hasten the second coming of Christ. In Falwell's words, quote, "Nothing would bring the wrath of the Christian people, the Christian public, down on this government like abandoning or opposing Israel in a critical matter." End quote. The lobby, of course, has a commanding presence in Congress, in state legislatures, and local municipalities. Now, thanks to lobby pressure and the Israeli government's allocation of at least $32 million last year to defeat the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, or BDS, 21 states have passed laws or executive orders opposing BDS. The Congressional Anti-Boycott Act of 2017 that threatens BDS supporters with million-dollar fines and up to 20 years in prison has hundreds of co-sponsors. You could hear more about this at a workshop this afternoon. What most distinguishes the pro-Israel lobby is not so much the amount of money it spends. The health industry, for instance, apparently spent $500 million lobbying in 2016. So it's not so much the money, but it's the fact that it basically serves the interests of a foreign country and enables secretive foreign intervention in matters of democratic debate. Since its funding in 1959, AIPAC has evaded the oversight of the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Whatever your stance on BDS, we should all be troubled by the October revelation that Israel is funneling large sums to a powerful Chicago-based law firm to fight BDS, presumably by bringing lawsuits against BDS supporters. Three, a third consequence concerns Israel's role in the massive violation of Americans' privacy rights. Among documents leaked by Snowden is a memorandum of understanding between the NSA and Israeli intelligence, under which the NSA would provide raw intelligence to Israel, including on American citizens. Another provides information about the NSA's PRISM program, in which two Israeli-linked high-tech companies, Naris and Verint, intercept our online and telecom communications for the NSA. The data they gather can reportedly be accessed remotely by Israeli intelligence officials, agencies. A June 10, 2013 article in Haaretz headlined, quote, "In U.S. snooping affair, Israel firms at risk," that's the headline, "describe the ties that these firms have with the IDF's secret intelligence gathering unit 8200. Another Israeli firm, Amdocs, gathers metadata from U.S. call and billing records, including those of major telecoms and the White House and FBI. Four, fourth consequence concerns those most at risk from such domestic spying, Arab Americans and Muslims, who have in the U.S. been racialized as a suspicious other for nearly 50 years. In the Nixon era, Operation Boulder ethnically profiled Arabs, with the FBI receiving information about Palestinians directly from Israeli intelligence. By the 1980s, AIPAC, the Anti-Defamation League, and other groups were compiling files on Arab Americans in an effort to silence them and demonize them as terrorists. In the 1990s, Arabs and Muslims, many of them Palestinian, were exclusively targeted for indefinite detention through the use of secret evidence alleging they were national security risks. No terrorism charges were ever brought against them. And after the attacks of 9/11, you will recall that racial and religious profiling led to massive arrests of Muslims and Arabs. The media was dominated by anti-Palestinian terrorism experts like Steve Emerson and Daniel Pipes, who depicted the Palestinian struggle as a global jihad front. By this time, Israel was being presented as an indispensable ally in the war against terrorism, since hadn't it been fighting terrorism for over 50 years? Methods deployed against Arab Americans and Muslims have undermined not just the First Amendment, but some other constitutional guarantees with implications for everybody. One example is the use in U.S. courts of disguised Israeli agents testifying from behind screens and using code names, a clear violation of the Sixth Amendment right of the accused, quote, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, end quote. And the fifth consequence, you've already heard from a bit from Susan, it is the impact of the U.S. relationship on the functioning of international law. Protected by the U.S., Israel has violated nearly every article of the UN, U.S. Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and ignored hundreds of U.N. General Assembly and Security Council resolutions. And one wonders how the U.S. can expect to promote itself to the world as a champion of human rights when it has done so much to undermine the functioning of the UN and the framework of international legality. Since 9/11, U.S. troops have trained in Israel in urban counterinsurgency and made ample use of methods that have long been part of the Israeli arsenal against Palestinians: indefinite detention, extraordinary rendition, so-called extrajudicial killings, and forms of torture that have long been routinely practiced in Israel. Both countries have crafted elaborate legal arguments to shore up profoundly illegal practices. Both have set aside the Geneva Conventions, called quaint by former U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, and behaved as if certain categories of human beings do not deserve human rights. And both claim to be acting in self-defense as they unleash their military might and kill with impunity. And what is striking about the forever wars in which the U.S. is now engaged and Israel's forever conflict with the Palestinian population is the shared refusal to examine root causes. What is much more lucrative is dehumanizing the enemy, keeping the home front fearful by incessantly banging the drum of terrorism. And I urge you to read Jeff Halper's book, War Against the People, that documents Israel's rise to the top of the securitization industry and its pioneering methods of social control that have been exported to the U.S. and around the world. What other country can offer such extensive war on terror know-how, as well as security technologies and weapons that are, in Halper's words, quote, the products of continuous engagement in real-life on-the-ground laboratory of the occupied Palestinian territory, end quote. Let me conclude on this Veterans Day by saying how critically important it is to curb the military aggression that has defined and deformed both the United States and Israel from its earliest days. The work to undo white supremacy and the legacy of settler colonialism in the United States is of a piece with the work to usher in freedom, justice, and equality for the Palestinian people. And in so doing, we have a better world to win. Thank you.
You have been listening to Leila Farsak and Nancy Murray speaking at the Balfour Legacy Conference in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Our coverage of the conference will continue next week, so please join us then. We began the program this morning with an article by Palestinian journalist Ali Abu Nima reporting on the collusion between the Trump White House and Israel. We end with another take on the issue by another journalist, Richard Silverstein, who writes the Tikkun Olam blog devoted to exposing the excesses of the Israeli National Security State. His work also appears in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, the Los Angeles Times, and Seattle Times. This article, titled "The Curious Case of Jared Kushner and the Israeli Lobby," appeared in the publication Middle East Eye. Leaders throughout the region and analysts who've devoted much of their lives to pursuing this goal were stunned that the U.S. had charged a young man with no previous experience except negotiating commercial real estate deals with resolving one of the world's most intractable problems. Since Kushner, whose family has made significant donations to Israeli settlements, was already known to be heavily pro-Israel in his approach, he determined that the Saudis were the key to unlock the Arab part of the equation. So he's made three visits to the Saudi kingdom in this past year. He brought his father-in-law on the latter's first foreign trip as president to visit King Salman and the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The goal was to flatter and cultivate the Saudi royals, expecting them to bring along the Palestinians and the rest of the Arab world towards that ultimate peace deal. This was an astonishing turn in U.S. relations because, though the Saudis are nominal allies, the two countries have had a contentious relationship going all the way back to 9/11. This is in part because 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi nationals, and wealthy Saudi patrons heavily financed Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. The Trump-Kushner pivot towards Saudi Arabia accords with a similar Israeli embrace of the House of Saud due to the two states' common enemy, Iran. In this and other ways, Kushner is placing U.S. Middle East policy in lockstep with Israel. That certainly leaves the Palestinians, among others, out in the cold. Many analysts who study the region question whether the U.S. putting all its eggs in the Saudi basket is wise considering the unpopularity of the autocratic, theocratic regime, both in the region and the world. Last week, the Wall Street Journal reported a new development in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. Did Jared Kushner violate the Logan Act after he lobbied UN Security Council members to sabotage a resolution denouncing Israeli settlements? The act dates back to the earliest days of the Republic. In 1799, America was in its infancy, and it was extremely sensitive about foreign meddling in its affairs. The great powers of that day were only too eager to interfere with the domestic and foreign affairs of the weaker states if it was in their interest. For that reason, American legislators passed the Logan Act, which prohibited private citizens from becoming agents of foreign states in trying to influence U.S. foreign policy. The act, as it was implemented, became something of a double-edged sword, as it enabled the political party in power to target anyone in the opposition who exercised his right to lobby for a particular policy regarding various foreign states. Eventually, virtually everyone realized that a weapon you used against an opponent could be wielded against you once you were out of power. So the act fell into limbo. Only one individual was ever charged with violating it, and it was never prosecuted. But news that Kushner was under suspicion of violating the act raised interesting issues. Though many U.S. politicians have been accused of being shills for Israel, and the Israel lobby holds sway over an enormous number of legislators, and though numerous Americans have been convicted of spying on Israel's behalf, no one has ever been convicted of harming the interests of the United States for Israel's sake. In fact, the rallying cry of the lobby is that there is no difference between Israel and U.S. interests. In other words, when you work on behalf of Israel's interest, you're also advancing America's. Of course, this is utter nonsense. It turns both countries into awkwardly co-joined Siamese twins. That's certainly what Kushner did in this case. Netanyahu, who initiated the request for Trump's intervention in the UN affair, wanted to fend off the resolution at all costs. It was originally put forward by Egypt. Because Israel has tremendous leverage over the Egyptian military-led government regarding intelligence sharing on Sinai Islamists, and because of Israeli attacks in Sinai, which have killed militants on Egypt's behalf, the Israeli leader was able to persuade Egypt's president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, to back off. But this strategy failed because four other member states stepped forward and sponsored it. Then Netanyahu sought to lobby the Russians and Chinese, who also were unmoved. Running out of cards to play, Netanyahu turned to Trump's right-hand man, Kushner. Then Trump's camp began working the phones. It was clear from Netanyahu on down, and including Trump, that the goal was to destroy the resolution which had the tacit support of the Obama administration. Though the U.S. in the end abstained, the Obama administration clearly did nothing to stop the resolution, meaning it tacitly supported it. In the past, it had actually vetoed virtually identical Security Council proposals, so the abstention was quite a bold move for the U.S. Therefore, Kushner's intervention to kill the resolution crossed the line from using his First Amendment right to speak freely about government policy into subverting official U.S. foreign policy. This is legal ground which is yet to be plowed. Including the Logan Act in the list of charges against Kushner would not only be novel, it would put the Israeli lobby on notice that it had crossed a red line, and that once you cross that line, you're actually engaging in criminal behavior. That would be a first, a shocking shot across the bow that would set the lobby reeling. However, it is doubtful that Mueller would make the Logan Act a key element of his legal strategy. When you're pursuing a president of the United States, you don't want to dabble in untried or esoteric legal theory. But including a Logan Act violation would be the equivalent of mood music, setting the tone for the overall indictment. In other words, we're talking about high crimes and misdemeanors here, and not run-of-the-mill charges. Much like a spy who betrays his country, Kushner acted against the best interest of the United States. That's certainly an impeachable offense when and if it comes around to Trump himself. What Kushner did is to violate a cardinal rule of American life. He showed dual loyalty. This is a canard that anti-Semites used to throw around against Jews. But today, given the eagle-clawed grip the Israel lobby holds over aspects of American politics, dual loyalty is once again a claim raised, and this time validly, against American Jews like Kushner, who put the interests of Israel above those of their native country. As the guiding force behind the Trump Middle East peace plan, an indictment by the special counsel against Kushner would significantly damage this effort. That might mean that a plan which is already derided by the Palestinians as hopelessly biased in Israel's favor might die at birth. That was an article written by Richard Silverstein in the publication Middle East Eye. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Or listen to us later in the day or at any other time via the instant archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive, go to Sunday morning at 8 a.m., and click on Listen. However, each program is only on this archive for 2 weeks. After that, to reach our permanent archive to hear all our past broadcasts, access truthandjusticeradio.org on your browser and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.